Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality and further beyond. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today, delighted to be joined again by Professor Richard Wilkinson, who's the author of The Spirit Level, Why Equality is Better for Everyone, and also the more recent book, The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. And Richard is a global expert on the area of equality and inequality, and is also a social epidemiologist. And if we look at inequality right now, we look at the impact of COVID, the recession, there's no doubt that inequalities have worsened. And we'll be seeing in January, the global leaders who meet in Davos every year with the wealthy are having a virtual meeting this year, but there will still be global events and protests being coordinated by, amongst others, the Fight Inequality Alliance. And if you're interested in finding out more, go to the Fight Inequality Alliance to find out about that. They're taking place from the 23rd to the 30th of January next year. Richard, thanks so much for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
Well, it's nice to be able to meet you again.
Yes, lovely to have you back. Richard, maybe you could start with kind of setting out your kind of the main ideas that were at the heart of your research, because I really think there's such a huge value. And, you know, now more than ever in the midst of this pandemic and the recession related to it, to, you know, the ideas that you set out, you know, in both the spirit level and the inner level about the impacts of inequality on people at all sorts of levels.
Well, I often say that people used to have a very naive view of inequality, that they thought it only mattered if it created dire poverty. But what we've done is to show how many forms of social dysfunction and ill health are caused by bigger income differences. I like to say that inequality is a social relationship. It puts us one person above another or below another. It makes a hierarchy out of us. It makes some people seem better than others. It increases those feelings of superiority and inferiority. That whole area of stuff becomes much more problematic. And that doesn't just lead to more crime, more violence, worse health. But it also gets to us very personally, in that those issues of self-worth are worries about what other people think of us, how we're seen and judged by other people. Those all become much more difficult in a world where some people seem supremely important and other people are regarded as almost worthless. We all become more neurotic about those kinds of things. We find social contact more difficult. It provokes more anxiety because we're worrying about whether people think you're boring, stupid, unattractive, all those kinds of things. It makes us spend much more time and energy, the energy of anxiety, if you like, on self-presentation. And that's not only in worrying about, whether you sound clever or not, but it goes right down into women spending more time on makeup or people worrying more about wearing the right clothes with the designer labels or what their car looks like. So it feeds into consumerism. An enormous range of outcomes like this are made worse by bigger income differences. It breaks up all the forms of reciprocity, community, conviviality, if you like, and social cohesion. All that gets worse and gives way to this nasty hierarchical business.
And is it, you know, the case that, you know, when you look at more equal societies, and maybe you could give some examples, and I know, you know, you cite in your books, you know, countries like Japan, for example, and obviously the Nordic countries, but, you know, what are the outcomes there that are so different from more unequal countries?
well, they live longer than people in more unequal countries, if you just compare life expectancy. The differences in death rates are particularly at younger ages, working age people, and infant mortality, things like that. But also violence and so on increase. Child well-being is lower in more unequal countries. So, you know, if you compare the Scandinavian countries that have smaller income differences between rich and poor with the United States, which amongst the rich developed countries has the biggest income differences, you find that the US has higher homicide rates than any other rich country. It has amongst the lowest life expectancy. It has the biggest prison populations. It has more teenage births. It has higher levels of obesity. And you can see all these things are typical of more unequal societies and typically better in the more equal ones. So it's a very clear and very important pattern. And it's not something that, you know, we discovered alone. The work on the relationship between health and inequality and violence and inequality has been going on since the 1970s. We extended that, showing how many other social problems, other forms of social dysfunction are part of that picture. We also showed, I suppose, that it's not simply the physical effect, the direct physical effects of poverty that are driving these relationships with inequality. It's the psychosocial issues, the worries, as I said, about how you're seen and judged, that are very similar to the unpleasantness of racism. Or prejudice on gender grounds, any of those things that make you more worried about what other people, how they see and judge you and your self-worth.
And you talk about this in terms of like the, maybe you could explain a little more like the impact of that kind of stress and anxiety. How does it impact on people?
Well, I think the most obvious effect is increases social anxiety. So we all suffer from these issues to a very different extent. I mean, there's some of us who are very confident, thick-skinned, able to deal with it all. Others who are very vulnerable. The most vulnerable, they start to find social contact so difficult, so anxiety-provoking that they simply avoid it. Yeah. They don't go out in the evening. They don't go to gatherings where they, you know, have to put on a performance. But you also get people who, you know, they shut themselves away. They don't like going to the door when the bell rings or answering the phone if they don't know who it is. So I think that's the extreme form. But even responses like violence are related because, you see, violence is so often triggered by people feeling loss of face, humiliation, looked down on, disrespected. And, you know, if you put me down, there's one way I can make you respect me.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, if you don't have other forms of status. And it's more common in more unequal societies because those issues become more important. Inequality raises the stakes. These issues become more prominent for all of us.
And no, it's like, I think it's something that, you know, you've been, you know, writing and researching this for, you know, decades and decades, you know, a long period of time. How have you seen it, you know, people's engagement with it, and particularly I would say, you know, the public debate about it? How do you see it shifting, or do you see it changing?
I think now that although people don't understand it in detail, I think people are much less willing to dismiss inequality as if it had no effects apart from possibly creating absolute poverty. I think there is a very widespread sense that somehow more is involved in it, that in some way it's bad for societies. And I think that that has changed over the last, 10 years or so. And the Occupy movement was very important in getting more attention to inequality in the media. There have been just so many books and newspaper articles and radio and television things about inequality, and so many compared to the lack of any of that stuff before we wrote The Spirit Level. I think there is a growing awareness, so people are not quite so surprised if you say that mental illness is more common in more unequal societies. I think, there's an intuition that, that sort of thing isn't too implausible. When you show people the evidence, they're willing to think about it.
And it is something that, I think as well, people are, increasingly seeing that, inequality doesn't just affect, and you make this point, the very poor, that more unequal societies and the more inequalities that exist affect everybody across society. And, I think about it, in the situation that I look at a lot is the area of housing and homelessness, for example. And, you can look at it a number of ways. For example, housing inequalities now, affect the middle class because, people are stuck renting or stuck living at home. Their children are living at home. But I even think in terms of homelessness, that people's overall sense of well-being as a society is worse, when they have to think about, or not have to think about, but are either worried of becoming homeless or, don't feel good about themselves because we have such levels of homelessness. Would you agree with that, or would you see it differently in how it affects people across society?
Well, I remember the left-wing politician, died some years ago, Tony Benn, saying that the unemployed and the homelessness were there intentionally to frighten us.
Yeah.
The government accepted levels of unemployment and homelessness because they may make us, the rest of us, more compliant, more willing to accept whatever's on offer. And I do remember in the 1960s, when there was really full employment, and you knew if you told your boss you could stuff the job, you could get another job within a week. It wasn't a problem. And so I do think those things change the balance between the establishment and the rest of the population, between capital and labor, whatever terms you use, between rich and poor, and institutions like trade unions that are established to strengthen the hand of labor were deliberately weakened from the 1980s onwards, when income differences started to rise. There was a deliberate policy to shift the balance between capital and labour, the balance of power. I'm afraid it was only too successful.
I think a lot of people, some people would see that, or would agree that, yes, that's they can see for trade unions. But for example, homelessness, they would find it hard to imagine that a government would purposely, allow people remain in homelessness as a strategy to make, the population afraid or, less willing to challenge.
Well, now, one of the things the COVID pandemic has done is show us how easily the government can spend large sums of money when it wants to. And indeed, they pretty well ended homelessness in the first lockdown because they thought it was important to the spread of COVID in the rest of the population. I don't think that we should think that homelessness is there because it's such an impossibly difficult problem to deal with. I think we have to accept that it's there because governments tolerate it and may even think it has some marginal worth for them. And I do think that the kind of self-serving theories the rich have about their superiority and also about the failings of people at the bottom that the rich see as signs of the inferiority of the poor, you know, that it's the homeless because they're lazy and stupid or something, that kind of thing. And that's what makes these forms of deprivation so painful. And you talk to somebody who's homeless, and it's not just the physical discomfort of sleeping out or the coldness or not having proper accommodation. It's feeling that your life has collapsed and you're regarded absolutely as the dregs of society, looked down on by everyone. And I remember an extraordinarily interesting story about, can I remember it properly? When medical students used to be taught anatomy on the bodies of paupers back in the 1920s and 30s. And then suddenly they started being taught on bodies donated by middle-class people for medical education. And they found the adrenal glands were much, much smaller than they were used to seeing in the paupers' bodies. And they couldn't think why. And they actually invented an explanation which was called idiopathic adrenal atrophy. It turned out later that the middle class people had had much less stressful lives and their adrenal glands were smaller. You know, when you're constantly stressed, there's high levels of adrenaline running around you. People have failed to see how important the psychosocial effects are of inequality. And indeed, that's why the effects of inequality are not just at the bottom of society. Although the biggest effects of inequality are at the bottom of society, the biggest effects on health or violence or anything else, even amongst, you know, well-educated middle-class people with good jobs and incomes, you see that they do less well in more unequal societies because even there, people are concerned with status and how they're seen and judged, and those problems are worse with more inequality. There's a nice paper actually by Leighton Whelan to Dublin academics showing that status anxiety is higher in more unequal societies in all income groups. So you can look at the poorest tenth of the population, you can look at the richest tenth of the population, and in more unequal societies, all the way across, the higher levels of status anxiety. So, you know, people are feeling all the time that they're being judged. You know, and you have to put on a good performance. And it's, that is an important a contributor to the and damage to the quality of life. When people talk about measures of the quality of life, they very rarely include, or just about never, measures of these kinds of insecurity that make it harder for us to meet and relax with each other.
Mm.
And yet, if you look at measures of happiness and health and well-being, you find that the nature of social relationships is crucial. You know, how many friends have you got? That's highly protective of health. People who have more friends live longer. And the same with happiness. Number of friends, the quality of your relationships, whether you're involved in community life, all really powerful determinants of well-being. And so what inequality is doing is undermining the core of the quality of our lives, the social core.
And it is, it's a very, very important point. And I think that, you know, there is, you know, such growing interest both in inequality itself and in mental health and the impacts of mental health and these ideas of well-being. And, you know, even in Ireland now we have, you know, during COVID, for example, the government talking about, you know, concern for people's well-being, for their mental health in ways that we hadn't heard before. Do you think that, you know, on the first hand, in the first respect, has COVID and obviously the recession really that's resulted from it, but also the lockdowns, kind of, do you think exacerbated inequalities? And and even from your own observations and kind of assessment, looking at the situation, you know, between, for example, those, you know, lower paid workers who had to go to work and the middle class who can stay at home, and what that means in terms of housing conditions, for example, those people who are locked down in overcrowded, damp conditions versus people who have huge, spacious houses. Do you think that the COVID pandemic, the required response, plus that recession, do you think it's exacerbated inequalities in what you've seen?
I have no doubt that that COVID has increased inequality of income and health. And death rates from COVID have got similar distribution to so many other death rates. And, you know, there are these huge social class differences in life expectancy, and COVID is just another disease that fits the familiar pattern. But as you say, the pandemic has also increased income inequalities, because people who can work at home, usually the better off middle class occupations, suffer no loss of income. In fact, their expenditure probably goes down, because they don't have to spend money on commuting, they go shopping less. And so actually their financial position has probably improved as a result of COVID, whereas people who've had to go to work use, often having to use public transport and so on, much more exposed to infection. So many of them, of course, have been laid off from companies that are either gone bust or can't trade during the lockdown. So, yes, it has made things worse, both in terms of health and income differences. But I think the big thing COVID has also done is to make us more aware than we were that we really are a society. That one person's behavior affects the risk for others. And in a way, infections, you know, you might almost call them social diseases, because they spread from one to another. They're affected by our behavior in relation to each other. Interestingly, the issues to do with friendship and so on Interestingly, people who are more isolated socially, usually because they have more worries about social contact, they find social contact more stressful. It turns out that those kind of stresses weaken your immune system. So although they might be a little bit, people with those social anxieties are a bit better protected because they don't have fewer social contacts.
Yeah.
They're more vulnerable because they have a weaker immune system.
Yeah. And it is very striking that, you know, that COVID has shown that and you know, that because that is, everybody talks about it, you know, we're missing our social interactions, you know, that people are feeling isolated and, you know, as you say, more vulnerable. And I think it is significant that emphasis on society and the responses that governments initially put in place, things like, you know, banning evictions and, you know, supporting, you know, here in Ireland, we'd significantly increased investment in our public health system. You know, things that were said couldn't be done before were done. And I just wonder, you know, do you see an opportunity now or a moment? Could this be a moment where we actually say, you know, we see the pandemic, its impact, people think more about us as a society, that we can actually, in countries that are more unequal, that we can actually say, you know, we need this pandemic, surely must rock us a bit to go, we have to address our inequalities. Isn't it time that we actually really, you know, really address them?
Yes, I think it's possible that we're moving towards a bigger picture that'll even start to influence business and so on. I saw a paper earlier today, a research paper in a peer-reviewed journal, talking about how the more equal Asian countries do better in economically, as well as all sorts of ways I've mentioned. They've done better through the COVID epidemic with much lower death rates per head of population. I think that it's clear that, and surveys show that the vast majority of the population don't want to go back to what we had before. They want to go back to something better. It's not clear what people think the better is, but I think there is that greater value and recognition attached to the social, that we need that social contact. It's part of being human, that we are society. I remember very well Mrs. Thatcher saying, there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals and families, you know. And yet now there is so much evidence that shows that the sort of reciprocity, the helpfulness, the public spiritedness is absolutely crucial to social functioning. As I say, not just social functioning, but how the economy works as well. I mean, it's every field of human activity involves now cooperation, our involvement with each other. You know, production is a highly cooperative activity. We make small contributions to things that hundreds, perhaps thousands of other people contribute to. You know, whether you're teaching or making cars or, I don't know, running dry cleaning store, you're doing things for other people. And you're often one of a number of people working together to provide that service or whatever.
And, you know, and I think even like the, for example, the whole idea of essential workers and, you know, be they health workers, childcare workers, you know, bus drivers, the, you know, the bin, the street cleaners, all these jobs that, you know, neoliberalism and the dominant market, you know, didn't value. And there's a question of, you know, and obviously they need a lot more than claps. They actually need, you know, proper paying conditions. But I wonder, is there, you know, because that's something central to you, you know, that you've made the point about that status, you know, that I wonder, could there be a change in the status of jobs? So, and obviously they need to be paid as well, but along with that, that a revaluing of, you know, you think of care work, for example.
Well, I think there was there was temporarily a revaluing, as the clapping showed, but it didn't last very long. I thought it would make it impossible for governments to deny pay rises to essential workers. However, our Prime Minister Boris Johnson has managed to do that. He hasn't stopped pay rises for, I think, not for people in the health service. That would have been going just a bit too far, but other essential workers. And I think it did lead to a recognition that these people were putting themselves at risk because we all need them, that we're dependent on them for our daily food and so on. I think, though, that all my work is based on the view that status is influenced so powerfully by social position, by income. You know, the people you feel you above you, you look up to or look down on, it's a matter of social position. And I sometimes say that, you know, if somebody makes a lot of money and moves up socially, and if they're one of the very few people who manage to move from the bottom to the top, they won't at first be accepted. They'll be regarded as nouveau riche or something until they've sort of learnt all the cultural sort of niceties of the upper classes use to show their superiority.
Yeah.
And in the 19th century, people who moved down were for a generation just not just regarded as poor, they were regarded as genteel poor. Yeah. So, you know, it's the material position plus the cultural layers that cling to it that are made possible by having a high income, whether it's sending kids to private schools or being able to, afford cultural activities, I don't know, all that kind of stuff, which are used to mark status, to show status, and they always have done.
Mm. And do you think that we're reaching a point now of inequality that is, you know, beyond anything we've seen before globally? And if we look at the top, Jeff Bezos from Amazon, the billionaires, you know, the hundreds of billions, you know, heading towards trillionaires. And this idea is circulating that we don't need and shouldn't have billionaires. What do you think of that?
I'm sure that's right. I suppose the experts would say whether inequality is greater than it ever has been before depends a bit on how you measure it. But I don't think there's any doubt that there have never been people as rich as the super rich now. And it's absolutely obscene, the scale of differences, the scale of want and deprivation, and even in the rich countries, that there are queues for food banks and so on at the same time as, you know, people, individuals make so much money just during extra money during lockdown that could solve a great many of these problems, you know, if it was properly spent. And it I think everyone knows it's obscene.
But the question is, what can be done?
I think that there are a whole range of things that have to be done. And most obviously, the tax and benefit systems and even small businesses complain about the ease with which multinationals go in for tax avoidance that smaller businesses have to pay. And I've heard small business leaders saying that they think that it's evil that the big multinationals get away with setting up offices or even just nameplates in tax havens. There are lots of ways you can get rid of other forms of tax evasion by individuals. And, you know, when there have been these occasional leaks of huge quantities of data from the data leaked or pinched from some of these banking systems, you can see instantly, the richer you are, the more likely you are to go in for these forms of tax avoidance.
Yeah.
So we must clear up all that. We must make tax progressive again, so the rich pay a higher proportion than the poor, as they used to. But even more important than that is, I think, forms of employee representation, employee control of companies. We must extend democracy into the economy. In the past, you can see a very clear relationship between what's happening to inequality, whether it's going up or down, and the proportion of the population in trade unions. It used to be trade unions and the labor movement and the fear of communism that stopped those top incomes getting out of hand. When all that got weaker, when those communist regimes collapsed, trade unions were deliberately weakened by legislation, inequality rose dramatically. I think the people like Thatcher and Reagan responsible had no idea of the range of consequences that they were giving rise to as they increased inequality. Mm. But, you know, the big change we must really see is that extension of democracy into the economy. I think that the way in which our political democracies make less and less sense, less and less meaningful, in a way demands that it's underpinned by a more local democracy in your workplace. And of course, the few surveys there are show that employees want much more say in what goes on at work, and they know so much about it. They know more usually than the financial elite who are parachuted in as directors. So I think there are a lot of reasons why that is the direction in which we must move. You don't think your boss should have 300 times as much as you. It's possible that you think your boss should have twice as much as you, or even three times as much, but not 300 times as much.
Uh-huh. And the question then goes, you know, how do we get that? You know, given the trade unions have been weakened so much, you know, they still exist, they're still working away, but they don't have that reach. So the question is it a case of trying to rebuild trade unions, for trade unions to try and organize in new ways? Or is it, and along with, is it also, I wonder, you know, there's potential from social media. You know, we see the younger generations and across the generations using social media to pressure politics in a new way. And obviously that can be both, you know, go from the right or from the left, but there is potential in that, you know, to hold politicians to account. And then the other question is, of course, voting. You know, is there a way to shift it through voting as well?
Well, I don't know whether Ireland has proportional representation. I think it does, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah.
There's a move to get progressive parties to have alliances here. For instance, if the Labour Party will guarantee that it'll, if it comes to power with the help of other parties, to get proportional representation. But, you know, one of the things about forms of economic democracy is that there's been some interest even from the conservative side. Forgetting the name of our previous prime minister.
Theresa May,
yes. She said when she was campaigning...
I'd say you weren't the first person to forget her name.
She, while campaigning for the leadership of the Conservative Party, said she would introduce employee representation, and it exists. There's legislation for it in, I think, about half the member countries of the European Union. It needs to be strengthened. But I think that because there is good evidence that it makes companies more efficient, not only has social benefits, but improves even productivity, that there may be wider support than we sometimes recognize. And indeed, I think the if there are super rich business leaders who oppose those moves towards forms of economic democracy, then they are not acting in the best interest of their companies. And indeed, there are now studies which show the companies in which the CEOs are paid most have lower shareholder returns. So even their shareholders should be opposing it. But I think actually the main drive for these changes must come from a much broader swathe of the population, that we must recognize, and more to do with the importance of social bonds and so on, and the need to reduce inequality, that we've got to build back better. It's intimately related also to how we deal with problems of the climate crisis. I've been writing bits about how inequality is an essential obstacle to dealing with climate change, because one of the things it does is drive consumerism. I sometimes mention Britain's policy in the war to try and make people feel the burden of war was equally shared, and to take part in the war effort. The government recognized if they were going to get that willing cooperation in the war effort, they had to reduce inequality. And they made major reductions, not only by rationing of food and taxes on luxuries and subsidies on necessities, but also by reducing the pay differences and, of course, the ending of unemployment and so on. But they also, the other thing that's relevant to moving towards sustainability, solving our environmental problems, is that, again, during the war, the government commissioned the Beveridge Report and set up an idea of a society, a future society worth fighting for, that we would have a national health service, that we would have decent benefit systems and so on. And I think we have to do that to get people to take part in the burden of moving towards sustainability. We have to build in with sustainability an idea of a society that's qualitatively better. I think there are a number of ways in which we can do that.
Well, listen, Richard, thank you so much for giving us the time today. And I know a lot of people will find that really, really valuable and, you know, engaging. And there's so much in there that I think, you know, you have contributed already and continue to contribute. So I thank you for that. and for inspiring myself and many others to, you know, to look at inequality, to try and address it. And ultimately, you know, I would have the belief, and maybe I'll end on this, that, you know, we can end inequality. We can create much, much more equal egalitarian societies. And really, we have to.
If we live in things that are anything like democracies, of course we can change these systems that benefit only the top 1 or 2%. And it's ridiculous that we put up with it. Of course we have the power to change it.
Great. Richard Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
Thank you very much.
And as always, if you want to become a patron, support us, go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We are an independent media that produces these podcasts. Support us, sign up for whatever you can each month, and help us out to keep going. Thank you so much and talk to you soon.
I think perhaps one of the important seeds of change for the better is the sort of work you're doing on podcasts like this. Setting up alternative news services. I have been very impressed by Double Down News and by Counterpunch, but I think there are a number of efforts to create a better informed public. I do think that our awful society and politics is a result of the awful media we've had in the past. And that we are beginning to change that for the better. And so I'm very grateful to you for doing this podcast with me.